welcome to the sixth edition of the Media Schwitz. I am the host, Mark Glazer with PBS Media Shift, and co-host Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
Hey, Mark. It's going well. How are you doing?
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Oh, thank you. Happy Cinco de Mayo to you, too.
I guess they don't really celebrate that as much in your little India area, huh?
I haven't gone down today. It's actually a beautiful day today, but I'm going to go down and see if there's an Indo-Mexican fusion stuff going on.
Yeah, and today you've got the Indian Film Festivals happening too, huh?
Yeah, they actually started last night. The opening was last night. I didn't go, but I'm very excited because a bunch of movies, Indian Film Festival is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There are probably about 20 movies or something, and I'm going to 15 of them, I think, in the next 5 days. And it's going to start later today. I'm going to go 3 o'clock. And a lot of good movies, and they're English, Hindi movies, English movies, some of the local language movies as well, some documentaries, some shorts and stuff. So I'm quite excited about that.
So this is beyond just the Bollywood kind of mainstream
stuff.
This
is, yeah, actually it's not even, yeah, it might be, I think there's one movie that's more mainstream Bollywood. There's one very interesting movie that is pertinent probably to our listeners, is, or at least American listeners, is there's a documentary called Made in India about women and families here who go to India to get surrogate mothers for their, to have kids.
Wow, well, that's fantastic. Well, enjoy the fest.
Oh, thank you. And that's my whole week right there.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like you have time for a lot of other things.
Yeah, not too much work this week, that's for sure.
Yeah, extend the sabbatical a little bit longer.
Actually, funnily, today is the day, May 5th, exactly last year, that I officially told people in the company that I'm leaving.
Wow.
Big content, so it's been exactly 1 year. And I somehow remembered it this morning, and I posted something on Facebook and Twitter that it was exactly a year ago that I decided I was going to leave. And of course, there's a lot has happened in that year. So what's been happening on your side?
Oh, we have two new editors for MediaShift that are starting, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Congratulations.
Courtney Lowry is the new managing editor, and Desiree Everts is the new associate editor who's going to focus on Idea Lab. So really excited to have them helping out.
So what are the stories we have lined up for today?
So today we've got, the first story is about Osama bin Laden being killed by American forces and just how that played out over Twitter and social media. Who broke the news, who kind of accidentally broke the news, what that means about Twitter as being part of the news cycle. Then we're going to have guest on from Demand Media. It's a big day for Demand Media. They're doing their quarterly earnings. We'll have Larry Fitzgibbon, Executive VP, and Jeremy Reed, Senior VP from Demand Media, on to talk about some changes that they're going to be doing. They're not going to be, their content farming is going to have a little bit of a different take. And then we'll talk about Apple backing down on its subscriptions for iPads, with Hearst and Condé Nast both making deals to kind of help them as far as how they're splitting the revenues for subscriptions, and also who gets the data about subscribers. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. So first, let's talk about Osama bin Laden. That was really the biggest news of the week. How did you first hear about it?
Or biggest news of the year and the last
century,
10 years,
millennium, etc.
Yeah, I actually, it's funny. I was coming back from prayers in the night, and I was walking back home. It's like 10 minutes walking distance to my house. And I was checking Twitter on the way back, and somebody said in 7 minutes he's gonna President Obama has a thing going, has an announcement to make. And
right.
The distance from my place to the place I go to pray is exactly 7 minutes. So I started walking faster, and then I started getting tweets about, oh, maybe it's Osama bin Laden got killed, and then I actually turned on wh.gov/live, which is their live feed that works on mobile,
right,
on my phone. I was walking back, and turned out President Obama didn't speak for another hour after
that's
that.
That's right. I remember that.
So I was fine, but I was came back home, turned on Al Jazeera or CNN, and was watching Twitter feed flow by, and then of course everybody confirmed and stuff. And CNN was the only one who didn't want to say it, but really was saying it, and it was just a whole drama about that, as you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because it just like you're saying it, that's the way my reaction was. It wasn't so much where you necessarily heard the news first, but it's also you're just getting bombarded. There's so many different ways to get media that, you know, when you hear something big happening, you might turn on CNN, Fox News, someone like that on your TV, but then you'll also have your Twitter feeds up. You'll also be looking at Facebook. It's like you really start multitasking when these things happen.
Yeah, and if it's such a big breaking news of global significance, even though most of my followers are sort of in the tech media circles, you really know that they will be on it much, much faster than anybody else would. So, I mean, I guess these are media people, and that's what their job is. So, really, Twitter was, even if I wasn't, if I was at home online and access to TV, I would have turned, I mean, I would have turned to Twitter as I did in any case. So, and then CNN was beating around the bush for a long time, and then actually some of the other channels were much faster than them.
That's true. I mean, the interesting thing on Twitter is that this kind of IT consultant, Soheb Othar, who just happened to be living, I guess, right next to Bin Laden, you know, heard these helicopters landing and heard a big crash because I guess one of the helicopters crashed, and he heard it and basically started tweeting about it. And when you follow his Twitter stream, it's really interesting. He's getting information from other people. People are asking him questions. He's responding to it. And I mean, he went from probably a few hundred followers to I think 70,000 plus followers. I don't even know where he's at now, but he just, you know, became this kind of Twitter celebrity from what
Actually, he's
happened.
more than 100,000 now, but yeah, he's become a, well, the funny part is he's a reluctant, and actually that's the great part of it. He's a reluctant celebrity. He does not want any money from any media organizations. He's sort of droll, funny. He's sarcastic,
He doesn't
and I
even
get,
watch TV, right?
and he doesn't watch TV, and he owns a coffee shop. I think his life, I guarantee you, within the next year, whether it's Bollywood or it's Hollywood, would be turned into some sort of a story, either on his life or inspired by what's been happening to him.
Yeah. And we already know there's going to be a movie about the raid and killing Osama, but.
Multiple movies, I bet, yes.
But that's one. And then the other one is that Keith Urban, who's Donald Rumsfeld's chief of staff, he was kind of the first one to actually say, you know, I think Bin Laden has been killed. A lot of other people said, well, they had information about it even hours before that, some people at news organizations, but they kind of couldn't really confirm it. That was part of the problem, right?
Yeah, I think Daily News said that they had a tip 3 hours ago before anything even started, when the White House announced that they're going to do a live broadcast. So they couldn't confirm it.
Then there was this whole debate broke out, and I think this is happening every time where, you know, the first stories are, you know, Twitter helped break the story, and this was another big Twitter moment, and then other people coming in and saying, no, you know, this is just part of the way things are going to work now. You know, the Twitter's been part of so many breaking news stories. This is not necessarily a Twitter moment.
Yeah, I think the reactions on sort of both extremes on it. There was somebody who wrote, "Twitter is not journalism," and I'm saying, "Geez, come on." I think that the reality, as you and I see it in our daily lives, it's just a part of all of what we do, and especially for the subset that's on Twitter, especially for media, which is certainly on Twitter. That's their ex even if it's not a mainstream play. The media that broadcasts it to everybody else, to the mainstream, is certainly on Twitter.
It's definitely hard to ignore, and it's always feels like the first responder medium. You know, it's the one that it feels like everything's going to happen there first. And you're going to get the rumors and the, okay, Obama's going to give this speech. What's it going to be about? You've got, you know, people are, a lot of speculation. So you have to take everything with a grain of salt when you're on there. But it's a fascinating way to really see how kind of the sausage is made and how the behind the scenes stuff works.
And also, even now, like I'm getting a lot of stories through my Twitter feed about perspective, about different ways of looking at what Pakistan's role in this is, or what role torture played in trying to, and all of this, I'm not going to somebody's homepage and figuring this out. I'm getting through my Twitter feed and Facebook actually as well a lot.
Okay, let's turn to the demand media guest. Larry Fitzgibbon is Executive Vice President of Media and Operations at Demand Media. His responsibilities include managing operations for Demand Media's vertical properties in entertainment, games, knowledge, and outdoor lifestyle. Larry joined Demand Media as part of the founding team as Senior Vice President of Monetization and helped drive revenue for the company's network of content sites. Jeremy Reed is Senior Vice President of Content and Editorial. Jeremy joined Demand Media in March 2007. Prior to Demand, Jeremy was Vice President of Content at City Search and has written about books, music, business, arts, and travel for many publications, including the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Austin Chronicle, and Austin American-Statesman. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So first, tell us. I guess tell us, give us a little bit of background. There's been a lot of talk about this Panda update on Google. How much did that affect kind of your traffic and your revenues?
Yeah, I think we're going to cover that later today on our earnings call. So today we really want to talk about a couple of initiatives that we're also going to talk about, namely around some of the updates of content on eHow, as well as some new formats that we're going to be rolling out.
Okay.
I can talk a little bit about eHow. One of the things that we've done there since the inception of the company is back in 2006, is we really believed that there was a changing landscape in media, and we wanted to empower users to be able to share their thoughts. So in 2007, we launched a program on eHow which allowed the users to actually upload content themselves. And that was more kind of like a user-generated content platform that didn't go through our editorial process.
Right, so you just ask people to go ahead and upload stories,
That's
right?
right. It was, we believed that there were a lot of experts in the world, and they could bring to bear their sort of thoughts and expertise. In 2010, we actually shut that program down. So we stopped allowing people to upload content. And really the reason there was because we were having a hard time keeping the quality of content to the level we needed to. And it began to kind of get inconsistent with the kind of content that we were creating from our studio, actually. What we're announcing today is that we're going to shut that program down completely. And we're going to be either removing content or putting it through our vetted editorial process. So that's one of the big shifts. And when you think about it, look, a lot of this content was fantastic. These articles were written by passionate users who had expertise on, you know, certain topics. But the problem we had was some of it wasn't so good, and it was inconsistent with sort of our standard editorial guidelines.
What do you think that says about user-generated content? I mean, does that mean that, you know, it's something that's more difficult than maybe you thought or that other people thought? I mean, what do you think is the larger message about user-generated content that you're kind of pulling back?
I think a lot of platforms have had a lot of success with it. I think for us, again, there's a lot of really key lessons that we bring to bear because, and you know, in some senses, our Demand Media Studios, we're taking a lot of the same clues. Like we believe there's a lot of really talented professional writers around the country. They have specific knowledge about certain topics, and so we're applying that same kind of core concept. I don't think we're shying away from that. Our issue was that we're trying to create a consistent quality experience for consumers when they come to our site. And with this content, because it didn't go through our process, in some cases we were letting them down. And that's just not, you know, it's not really acceptable. So this move is really to ensure that every time a consumer comes to one of our properties, or in this case eHow, that they just have a great experience.
Yeah, I think there were two other things too that we pulled out of it. One was there's a lot more value to when you direct or you understand what you're assigning. And we weren't getting that with WCP, so we had some really great stuff, and we wanted to figure out how we could get more of that. And then just the value of an editor, like having the ability to run it through an editorial process where you've got somebody with an editorial background and subject matter expertise, had a real lift on consistency.
So you're saying editors are better than robots?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever had robots. But, you know, it's talking about, you know, having humans. But, I mean, I think that was one of the things. It's like when we saw WCP content, like everyone, there are people that can write and be very clear and explain a point and don't need an editor, but they're rare. And so we wanted to find more of those people, but for consistency, make sure they rerun it all through an editorial process.
Now, how are you guys done with the feature-length stories? Because when I talked to you, Jeremy, before, you guys were really talking about kind of beefing that up and you know, adding kind of longer features, paying the writers more and all that. How's that effort going?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's one of the things that we, you know, especially since our last conversation, have invested in even more. So we're announcing that we're launching a formal role of feature writer in the studio. And I think what we thought about why this was, the timing was right and why this opportunity made sense is if you look at a lot of the content that's coming in, it's coming in, you know, from search or from social with a very clear question, right? I need to understand this or I need to do that. But as we start to build our direct traffic, and especially on, you know, eHow, where we're seeing great direct traffic growth, we have an opportunity to create an experience around a category like food. So, you know, we partner with Rachel Ray, and then we can start creating lifestyle feature content that when somebody shows up, we can also entertain them and bring them into the experience through feature content. So, you know.
So is that more about a time on the site type of thing? Like, you know, you're getting people coming in, they get what they need, they get the how-to, then they leave. If you have something that's feature, I'm guessing they're going to be a little more engaged.
Yeah. I mean, I also think it's making sure you serve the audience in the way that they're taking in the content. So, you know, if somebody's coming for a very specific question that's a task, you need to be succinct and direct and to the point. And you don't need to have, you know, three or four of the best experts kind of ruining the clarity of the 500 words. But if somebody's actually showing up on the site and they're not coming with a specific question, but, you know, they, you know, they're interested in food, then you have the opportunity to entertain them.
We've really seen this with our property Cracked. It's one of the leading comedy sites on the web. And, you know, the content there is really designed to sort of delight, entertain, and engage the users. And on the back of that content, you know, we've grown that site dramatically.
This is Rafat. Are you thinking about sort of building more traffic through social as going ahead, and sort of where what efforts are you guys doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've always thought about the different sources of traffic. Search is obviously a dominant one for people seeking out specific type of information. We don't really see that, you know, slowing down. But there's also things that users want to pursue. There's applications now. Mobile's more important than ever. And then obviously, you know, with the emergence of some of the social platforms, creating the right kind of content and, you know, being in the right places is more important than ever. We're seeing really nice growth on eHow from some of those sources that you mentioned. Obviously, Cracked was sort of born of those different sources of traffic. I mean, Cracked is inherently social, and I would say we're one of the kind of the leading companies out there that created content that was, you know, really designed to, as I said, at the end of it, it needs to sort of delight and entertain, but worked really effectively on sites like Dig and Facebook and Twitter. But we're seeing a lot of success, and, you know, as Jeremy mentioned, with these new formats of content, they're really designed to play better in those places. So, you know, people on, I think at least, people on these social platforms, they're less there to answer a specific question and more to discover and be entertained. And so we need to create content that matches well to what that consumer's experience is, why they're there. And I think some of the shifts that we're making with some of the content we're creating kind of lends itself to those new platforms.
Yeah, with marketers and what you guys are doing, Is the push towards the long form, is part of that about marketer demand? Like, if you're going after brand advertisers, that's a lot different than just having, like, you know, kind of Google ads or links and things like that. I mean, you're talking about a more of an experience. So is some of this coming from what you're hearing from brands?
I think we've had recently, we've had a lot of success with brands. I mean, when we really started the company back in 2006, I think you kind of were pointing it out, we weren't really focused as much on direct relationship with advertisers. I mean, obviously, we had a much, much smaller business at that time. But as we've grown, you know, we really started to develop those capabilities. And, you know, certainly with some of the stuff that we've done more recently with brands, it's very clear that they're excited about our approach to media. They're excited to reach a consumer at this point of intent. And then they're also, you know, excited to, you know, be part of these rich experiences we're building. So when a user comes into the food section of eHow, and it's going to be, you know, wrapped with great content from Rachel Ray's Buddies, I think that's a pretty exciting opportunity for an advertiser.
How much of your effort is focused on deflecting some of the negative criticism against demand, whether it's trying to sort of proactively manage the journalist community on their views on the quality and sort of moral issues about content, which I frankly don't get worried about, but and then some of the other stuff about the numbers and how they were portrayed before the company went public and how and now that the numbers came out and sort of ongoing, how much of, I guess, your effort is aimed towards countering some of those issues?
Yeah, I think what I would say there is that this business has been in constant evolution. And so at each point, we've been excited to tell people sort of aspects of our story. I think one of the challenges we had last year was we were in a quiet period for really more than 6 months. And so a lot of people took the opportunity, you know, to talk our business, but they really didn't get a chance to talk with us, really learn how it works, look, you know, underneath the covers to understand, you know, what this new business model is. And so I guess since then, we've been very excited to do things like this, have this conversation with you today. And, you know, we encourage everyone to come see us. We're, you know, here in Santa Monica and all over the country. So, you know, we encourage everyone to come engage with us in this conversation, because we've been pretty steadfast over the last 5 years, and this business is really only 5 years old, in constantly evolving to create either better experiences through content or applications. So, you know, I think we feel pretty good about where we stand today on that topic. And again, you know, in terms of earnings and what we're going to talk about today, you know, the numbers will speak for themselves.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate you joining us. I know you got a busy day ahead.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so maybe you want to, I mean, what's your take? You're a little upset about, I mean, and this is something, I don't think you're alone in this, that a lot of people thought that the CEO of Demand, Richard Rosenblatt, had said, you know, we're profitable, we're doing great, and threw out some numbers, and then when the numbers finally came out during the IPO, it showed that they really weren't profitable, right?
Yeah, I think that was my issues with Demand are not anything to do with their business model or the quality of content or so the moral issues of them devaluing content. That as a business entrepreneur, those are the decisions they've made, and they've actually built a market that nobody had thought of before. I mean, people had thought of it before, but I hadn't looked at it that way. Of course, About.com was one of the pioneers in the space. My view of them, my criticism of them through tweets and stuff, because by that time I had already left paid content, my criticisms came out mainly through tweets that I did, were about what the company said prior to filing their S1 for the IPO. When they were a private company, they have been saying for the last 12 months, really, and the numbers that came out contradicted it.
I mean, I think that, you know, whether you take a view that, you know, what they're doing is somehow perverting journalism or perverting writing or coming up with the I mean, I think those arguments are kind of moot in the face of, you know, first of all, let's just see how long the business does last. I mean, they're obviously going to have some issues when Google changes their algorithm. They've lost some traffic around that. But, you know, the question is, I mean, one thing that they talked about that I think was really key is this thing about evolving their business. And now they're trying to do, they're obviously looking at quality. They're removing some bad quality content. They're, you know, they're trying to do long form content. So they're making moves that are trying to change who they are in a way.
Yeah, and it's whether they would want to say it or not, this is exactly a response to all the stuff that's been building up for the last year since, not last year, but the last months, I guess 6 months or something, with Google. I think they're realizing that they have to evolve the model. They have to move upstream, whether the profitability margins are lower on it or not. They would have to move upstream because they have no choice. I think that's really what their calculation is. And their also calculation is that, okay, beyond search, then what? So
right.
I would expect, this is my guess, I would expect them to make a relatively large acquisition in the social space to help them sort of build demand for their stories through that, whether it's buying Dig on the cheap or it's buying something else. It would be quite interesting to see what actually happens there.
So finally, let's talk a little bit about Apple and its subscription plans on the iPad. Previously, they had said, you know, we're going to take 30% of every subscription. We get to keep the data on the subscribers, and just tough luck. If you don't like that, take your business elsewhere. Now they're kind of, seems like they're backing down a little bit. They're allowing Hearst and Condé Nast to basically get cut different deals. They're able to keep their data. I think Time is now able to give their print subscribers free app access, which is another thing that they wanted.
Yeah, what do you think of Apple backing down? Or do you think it's really backing down?
Well, yeah, I think it is a little bit backing down. I think it's you know, it makes a lot of sense. I think publishers were really up in arms about this for good reason. That Apple was just, you know, they've obviously done a great job of building the App Store and building iPhone popularity and iPad, as we both know. But, you know, you can only go so far as someone who's almost a semi-monopolist. I mean, there are obviously Android tablets are going to come up and there's going to be a lot of competition. But at the moment, you know, they really have the tablet market cornered in a way, and they could kind of just dictate the terms. And that's not really – you're going to get regulators involved. You're going to get lawmakers involved. They're not going to like it. They really had to bend a little bit, and I think this is just showing that they're going to have to be a little more realistic than what they were doing before.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. Even though, from a publisher perspective, while this is temporarily good news, my view on this is that at every step they've said, "Oh, this is going to be our savior," or like Apple iPad launch, "Now this is going to be a savior." Okay, they launched single copy sales. Okay, now this is going to be a savior. Like now this is launched and say, oh man, this is going to be our big thing. And consistently has proven that hasn't necessarily been the case. So I'm hoping that the publishers are not like betting their horse and on okay, now we're going to be the big ones. And what I've said in the past as well is that if you suck in print and you suck online, chances are you'll suck on iPad, whatever your business model is. Yesterday, the Daily News Corp came out with their numbers, and the iPad app that they have, which is iPad newspaper.
iPad only.
iPad only. They lost $10 million last quarter, and they have 800,000 downloads. We don't know how many subscribers there are out of that. And I think that 800,000 download number slipped inadvertently during the call. I don't think they were supposed to tell that. But that's not blowing the socks off anybody, really.
No. No, I mean, I think that the magazine publishers have really, Yeah, they were going completely full on. You know, this the with the ta- when the first iPad came out. You know, this is going to be our savior. This is going to save magazine journalism, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, you know, if you're just going to port everything over onto another platform, how is that going to really knock anybody's socks off? You know, how is that going to really excite anybody? You know, I still think there's so much more potential for these platforms than it being tapped by the publishers.
I think it will have to. It will have to be something different from what their main product is. It will have to be sort of innovative stuff that they either buy or build that is completely different from their content first approach, which is what everybody has been. One of the things that I have advocated or said or talked about before is that these guerrilla dev teams that these media companies need to have that build applications for mobile, for iPhone, iPad, Android apps that are have nothing to do with their content, and like a service utility or anything else, frankly, that that just leverages the brand instead of the content. For instance, one of the examples that I had is New York Times. Why don't they have the definitive subway map app for New York?
Right.
Or Guardian for UK. I mean, these are
brands. Right. Where's the utility?
Where's the utility beyond, okay, where do we fit our content first? And that's the way they look at it. And I think that's
right.
That's,
and they put a, you know, you put a magazine on there and then charge what, $4.99 an issue, like you were getting a print magazine. I mean, that people weren't really going to go for that.
Yeah. I think we'll see, but I highly doubt if it's not read online, if it's not read in print, that it will necessarily be read on iPad.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer along with Rafat Ali. Thanks goes out to our special guests from Demand Media, Larry Fitzgibbon and Jeremy Reed, who just announced earnings that beat analyst expectations. So we'll see if they can keep that going. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to stay abreast of all the new media news at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister blog Idea Lab at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.